This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dave Thomas, but you also know him as Bob Hope, Walter Cronkite, and half of the McKenzie Brothers, hosts of The Great White North. Thomas was one of the Canadian comic actors who starred on the SCTV comedy series. Now he has his own five-part comedy series, Monday Nights on CBS. Each program opens with a monologue. This week, Thomas gave some tips on how to do an impression of Bob Hope.
I've noticed some things about Bob, some little idiosyncrasies that perhaps some of you have noticed. Like, when Bob is talking about beautiful and sexy women, his voice goes up very high, like this.
Hey, here's Stevie Nicks with her new hit single, and then joining me later in the show will be Kiki D with the pretty baby herself, Miss Brooke Shields, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, right here on the show.
But when Bobby is referring to important people, his voice drops way down, you know, like this.
Now, I did 9 holes with Maggie Thatcher the other day,
and I'll tell you, the Iron Lady can really smack a ball, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and we were out there with Malcolm Forbes and General Westmoreland, and then
Gerald Ford joined us on the back 9. You know,
and then we went to the lounge, and Kiki D was in there, and we had a drink with her.
Let me ask you to describe your vision of the show.
The idea of the show was to do a fast-paced sketch show, you know, with some kind of a home base reality that was the network's idea, of course. They like to be able to come back to the same place in case people become as frightened as they are. Anyway, so I just wanted to make the average length of the sketches about 2 minutes so that in a 23-minute show, I'd be able to have about 8 or 10 pieces in a show, you know, so that hopefully if a sketch wasn't funny, and no one thinks this, you know, no two people think the same thing is funny, commonly anyway, so that if someone didn't find it funny, at least it would be short enough that we would be on to the next one before it became really frustrated.
My favorite characterization of yours is Bob Hope.
And yeah.
I was wondering how you first did him.
Well, I'll tell you, what happened there was we were doing a thing, Brian Doyle Murray, Bill's brother, and I wrote a thing called the Bob Hope Desert Classic, which kind of combined two things that were real tough, close to Bob at that time, and that was golf and war. So I really didn't know how to do them. I'd never done them before. I'd done kind of just the high, whiny voice of Bob Hope here in, we're in Phnom Penh, 50 miles north of the DMZ, you know. So I was working on it, but I hadn't really sort of refined it. And then when we got into makeup and they put this, this was pre-prosthetics, and they put a wax nose on me. And I looked in the mirror and I said, gee, I still don't look like him. And they slicked my hair back and grayed it a little. And then Beverly Sheckman, who was the makeup designer, said, well, why don't you stick your jaw out, you know, because his jaw is bigger than yours. So as soon as I stuck my jaw out, I had kind of a little cup that I could speak into in the front here. And that, for all you lame impersonators out there that are trying to do them, that's the secret to how to do them. And the minute someone else gets them down, then I'll stop doing them too. So, but he was at a book signing in Century City yesterday, and a friend of mine dropped by and took a copy of his latest book to him to sign for me and said that he was very impressed that he had seen the shows. And he thinks that kid who does him is wild, you know.
On SCTV, you used to do Bob Hope to Rick Moranis' Woody Allen.
Yep.
Who came up with the idea to put the two characters together?
Well, Rick could do Woody, and I had done Bob. So, you know, we were always fooling around in the offices and kind of packaging unlikely combinations of people that would be put together, you know. And so we barked this thing into one of those little micro-cassette recorders one day, and it came out quite funny, the Play It Again Bob thing that we ended up doing with Woody and Bob together. So we decided to write it up as a sketch from the notes, and we changed very little, really, from what we improvised. And we shortened it, of course, but we changed very little of the structure of the piece. And we just thought that Woody had, especially in his earlier comedy, not like Interiors and darker stuff like that they did later, but in his earlier comedies, he borrowed a lot from Bob Hope. He played the coward character and was always kind of like backing out a door with gorillas, you know, like he'd take the money and run.
Yeah, you guys, well, no, you guys and Bob Hope was like, yeah, listen, hey, but I'm not the guy.
So that sort of borrowing the coward character, and he added the sort of neurosis touch. So we played with that in the piece, you know, that Bob would be talking to Woody about doing something together, but Bob wouldn't want to get into all that New York neurosis stuff that Woody, you know, was into, that kind of stuff.
Did you ever do jokes yourself?
When?
You know, stand-up jokes, yeah.
When I was a kid, you mean, or stand-up comedy?
Stand-up comedy.
No, I just started doing this. Ironically, I decided to wait till I was 40 to try stand-up. You know, all the other guys that are down there at these clubs are 20 years old, and so I kind of creak in and try my jokes out. And strangely enough, the way it's worked out is that I've been using The Tonight Show to work out my comedy act for the improv, because I'm doing a show that I'm doing a piece at the improv for. Instead of the other way around, you know, using the improv to work out your act for The Tonight Show, I've been testing my material on The Tonight Show for the improv. It's funny if you get it, you know. Anyway.
Oh, jeez. How come it's taken you till age 40 to try out stand-up?
Well, okay, this is maybe hard to believe, but I was really too busy to get to it. It's something I always wanted to do, but I came like right out of college, got a job in advertising, and then realized that was a joke. And then I got in, I saw Second City and auditioned for that, and then got in. And I was in the stage company for about a year, and then the TV show started. And I was in that for 6 or 7 years. And then, you know, and then I did some movies, and then next thing I got married and had a family, and then it was like, wait, slow down. My life is slipping between my fingers, you know? So I didn't get a chance to get to it until now. I mean, when we were doing SCTV, that was like 7 years of my life where I was like working 18 hours a day, 6 days a week. And to just be able to get your stuff together for the show, you were operating at your maximum capacity, you know. There was really no time for anything at all, even a personal life. That's why most of the people from SCTV have got kids about the same age, got married about the same time, because it wasn't until the show kind of broke and people had some time that they go, oh, I see, there's sex, there's relationships, there's all kinds of things, you know.
I want to ask you about the McKenzie brothers, another sketch that originated on SCTV. This was The Great White North with you and Rick Moranis. What's the story behind how you started doing this parody of Canadians and Canadian TV?
Well, the Canadian show was 2 minutes longer than the American show, and so this is when we were doing the half hour in syndication, and they needed something to fill that difference between the two shows, and they wanted to find something that they could do cheaply as well. So they suggested that we do something Canadian content. Well, we were kind of infuriated by this. That's a kind of a national neurosis in Canada, you know, that they're always talking about their identity and Canadian content and everything, and it's more of a phenomenon, a literary phenomenon, than it is a public phenomenon. But anyway, it's kind of irritating when you're doing a show in Canada with an entire Canadian crew, half the cast is Canadian, most of the writers are Canadian, and then the CBC and your producers turn around and say to you, could you do something Canadian? You know, you morons, this is Canadian already. But they didn't seem to think so. So as a joke, we said to them, well, what do you want us to do? Just put up a map of Canada and dress in ski hats and parkas and, you know, and talk like this, eh, like you can drink beer, like a... They said, yeah, that'd be great, and could you put a Mountie in the scene, too, you know? So that's what we did as a sort of as a joke at the producer's expense. And, of course, little did we know that it would catch on, you know? Again, you know, I've had people say, how did you plan? What was the design behind these characters? These characters are so typical of Canadian. Well, really, there was none of that depth behind it. And Rick will back me up on this. We were just clowning around. We were improvising, you know. We felt that, you know, Bob and Doug McKenzie have been given like a lot more depth and credit than they deserve. And so we're glad we canned them, you know. They were put to rest, R.I.P. By our hands, you know.
Yeah,
deservedly,
yeah.
So.
Do you think the CBC was sorry that they asked for this Canadian stuff, because they ended up with the kind of characters that wouldn't get you to want to move to Canada, you know?
Yeah, flattering.
Yeah, it wasn't exactly good PR for the country.
Well, actually, you know, the strange thing is, there is a sort of a feeling, and it was reflected in the way they were received in Canada, that, you know, any image is better than no image at all. And people would come to us and say, thanks for putting us on the map, eh? You know? And it was like, oh, okay, well, you're welcome.
What's the first writing or performing that you did?
Well, let me think. I guess it was, I didn't do anything in high school or public school. Grammar school? I guess it was college. I went to a small college in Canada, and I met Marty Short and Eugene Levy there. And there was really no drama school there, or no, or theater school, or film school, I should say, or TV, nothing. It was just a general arts school with a heavy sciences department and a lot of people in engineering. And so we started our own theater group and did plays, you know, and then after a while, we were doing three or four plays a year and not going to any classes at all. I had a ball with these guys in college, and, you know, we were there together for 4 years doing plays. So,
now, you wrote ad copy for a few years before joining SCTV, right?
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of stuff did you write?
Well, what happened was I was in Godspell, and then after Godspell closed, I tried to get jobs in theater, and I couldn't get there. At that time, there's a lot of underground theater stuff going on, and I remember there was one show, I can't remember the name of it, but it was a part that I was, you know, that I read for, and they said, well, yeah, you did good, actually, we'd like you to, we'd like to consider you for this, and, but it opened with me and another girl, nude in a video arcade. So I thought, well, you know, I can't invite my parents to come and see. This is sad, you know. So I actually quit show business. Marty and Eugene joked with me about that Dave went to two auditions and quit showbiz. So I wrote up some fake ads, and then I went through the yellow pages of the phone book and called up the creative directors of ad agencies. And by the time I got to the M's, I got hired at McCann Erickson.
So how'd you get back from advertising back into performance?
I became frustrated and bored there. I mean, there's only so long you can play second fiddle to a box of soap before you start to go, wait, this can't be all there is. And the guy who hired me was a very funny guy. His name is Harry Yates, and he had worked at Doyle Dane Burnback in New York. And when he hired me, he gave me a book called The Ad Man by Jack Dylan. It's a very morbid and depressing book. And at the end, the hero of the book is left on his front lawn. His wife and kids have left him. He's lying in a pool of his own vomit, and his life is completely destroyed and ruined. And Harry said to me, read this book, and if you still want to be in advertising after reading this book, report Monday at 9 a.m. for work. So I always had that book in the back of my head as you know, what the possibilities were, and in their most horrible form. And so then I went down and saw Second City, and I saw, you know, Dan Aykroyd and John Candy and those guys up on stage having a great time. And I started going down there and watching it a lot. And then I heard they were going to open a company in Pasadena, and they were sending three guys down there. They were sending Eugene Levy, Joe Flaherty, and John Candy to Pasadena. And Danny was going to stay, and I loved him and what he did. And so I went and just auditioned. And I auditioned every night for 5 nights. That's what you do. You do the improv sets with them every night for 5 nights. It was a really harrowing experience trying to improvise with Dan Aykroyd and John Candy and Joe Flaherty. I mean, these guys are real pros. But I got in. So I quit advertising so fast. You know, I mean, I couldn't write my letter of resignation quick enough.
What was one of the first improvs you had to do?
Well, I remember there was a life, this was when I was auditioning, there was a life raft scene, and it was Candy, Flaherty, myself, and Aykroyd on stage, and the deal was we were all stranded in a life raft. There was the usual sort of, like, emergency operation that had to be performed on a seaman, and then the sort of, like, don't drink too much of that salt water. All those gags, you know, from the movie Lifeboat and things like that. We exhausted all those. And then Joe bailed out. Joe, that's it. And I can't take it anymore. And he rolled out of the mime boat and swam off stage and through the curtain and exited. And then one by one, like, then somebody else left. And then I get the picture. I'm going to be out here alone. So I went third. And they told me afterwards, they said that was a really good sign, you know, that if people start bailing out and you're smart enough to get out first, then you pass the test, you know.
Oh, you would have had to do a one-man show if you were left.
Yeah, right. And I didn't want to do that. Not at that point.
So what's the status of your show now? How long is it going to continue? Do you know?
Well, I've got 5 of these half hours for CBS and then a one-hour special after that. And then I don't know. I think they're going back to sports after that. I don't really know. There's really no written future. You know, I cannot say it is written. It is not written. It is an unwritten book. I'll be in something. I'll do some other show, you know. I mean, shows keep popping up, you know. I would make some changes in that show. I would do some things differently than I did, you know. And so if I did more of those shows, I would do them differently anyway. So, you know, I'm looking forward to the opportunity to make changes in what I do. I get bored with stuff awfully fast.
Did you get bored with SCTV?
Well, I did, actually. That's the sad thing. I know a lot of people, how can he? That's why, that's blasphemy, I say. You know, there are a lot of real SCTV fans out there. And but the fact of the matter is, after, you know, working 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, you know, and anyone, no matter how devoted they are to something, would get, you know, tired or frustrated or run down or whatever. And I got to the point where I stopped impersonating, like, Walter Cronkite and Bob Hope and people that America knew about. And I started impersonating, you know, like, writers on the staff and doing them in scenes. And I did, like, Marty Short and Mike Short's father, who used to get up real grouchy in the morning wearing a Hawaiian shirt and only his underwear and a pair of, like, knee socks and his wife's slippers and cook sausages and just bitch and complain at everybody. So I did this piece called Charlie's Kitchen, and it was Charlie Short, Mike and Marty's dad. And an NBC executive came to me and he said, "What the hell is this Charlie's Kitchen?" I said, "Well, that's Mike Short and Marty Short's dad." He said, "Well, what's that supposed to mean to the rest of America?" I said, "Well, really, I don't know. I think it's sort of funny, but if you don't like it, why don't you just cut it?" And he said, "That's self-indulgent is what it is. It's self-indulgent." And he marched off. And then about a week later, he came to me and he said, "Have you seen Charlie's Kitchen?" And I said, "No, I thought you hated it." And he said, "It's great." And what had happened was he had taken a 5.5-minute self-indulgent piece and gone into the editing room himself and cut it down to a 3.5-minute self-indulgent piece, and through the miracle of creative involvement by executives, felt that he had turned the thing around, you know? They're so funny.
Oh, gosh. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
The Dave Thomas Show continues for the next two Monday nights on CBS.